Well, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to be here with you this week. And I don't think I ran anybody off after this morning, so I guess we're doing okay. I like to call this lesson God's footprints around the world, because you might not actually see him, but you can see evidence that he's been there. And today we're going to look at evidence of God in other cultures. And we're not actually going to specifically look at the Bible, although in the course of this we will look at lessons or stories from Genesis 1 through 11, and they're familiar stories. This is the outline of what we're going to be looking at, and so we're just getting started. And we already read our theme text, which is in Romans. But chapter 1 and verse 20 is really the theme verse. But as we followed this out, we saw that God told us that when we depart from him, we will start worshiping other gods and many gods. We worship his creation. That's actually the opposite of what we are taught in school. In school, we are taught that we worshiped creation, and then we started worshiping a monotheistic God. We went from polytheism to monotheism. And anthropology, through the years, has tried to teach us that. You look at Celsus, you look at Voltaire. Herbert Spencer was a friend of Charles Darwin, and his works are very much influenced by him. And the Principles of Sociology, which was written over 100 years ago, is still quoted a lot or referred to a lot. And so it's very influential. Mark Smith, back in 2001, while the chair of the Bible and Ancient Near Eastern Studies at the Department of Hebrew and Judaic Studies in New York University, so a Bible chair, he said the same thing. He said that he wrote about the Jews, and contrary to what we read in the Bible, he says that the Jews believed in God because it evolved out of polytheism, rather than God was there and then they took the Canaanite religion. And so this reminds me of 1 Corinthians 1, verse 26, where it says, not many mighty, not many noble according to the world are called. So then it starts making me, and maybe you think, well, I'm probably not mighty and I'm probably not very noble according to the world because not many are called. But what about this thought of polytheism versus monotheism throughout the world? Sir Flinders Petrie, the guy who started the study of ancient Egypt, the father of modern Egyptology, he said, were the conception of a god only an evolution from such spirit worship, we should find the worship of many gods preceding the worship of one god. What we actually find is the contrary to this. Monotheism is the first stage traceable in theology. So the guy who started the study of ancient Egypt said it actually started with they had a belief in one god, and that evolved into many gods. There's another Egyptologist, Sir Wallace Budge. And he said, as a result of their studies of Egyptian texts, many of the earlier Egyptologists came to the conclusion that the dwellers of the Nile Valley from the earliest times believed in the existence of one god, nameless, incomprehensible, and eternal. That sounds a lot like the God you read in the Bible. How about other countries? Stephen Langdon, who is a professor of Assyriology, he said, I may fail to carry conviction in concluding that both Sumerian and Semitic religions, monotheism preceded polytheism. The evidence and reasons for this conclusion, so contrary to accepted and current views, have been set down with care and with perception of adverse criticism. It is, I trust, the conclusion of knowledge and not of audacious preconception. So he's committing academic suicide here. He says, I know folks will say I'm wrong, but I've studied this. I've looked at the evidence, and this is what it says. If you look at the two views of data, there's always two views of data, it seems, sometimes more. But currently, it looks like 90% of the world's people groups started with monotheism and evolved into polytheism as you go through. And so if all these people had similar beliefs in God, there's really three things that could have happened. Either they all started believing in God spontaneously at the same time and then evolved into polytheism. Maybe there was a great trade network and oh, you believe in this? I like that idea. I'm going to take it up. And so it spread through their common communication. Or they had a common ancestral knowledge. And because there was a commonality there, they all had the same beliefs. Paul and I had an opportunity one time to go to China and work over there. Our preacher would go over every year, and we got to go with him. And the talk we're getting ready to get into is based on a book by C.H. Kang. And he stated that the stories of Genesis 1 through 11 are seen in my language. And we would go over there and present this lesson showing the commonality in an effort to get people, as they were wanting to study English, to also study the Bible. And so my question with all of this is, does the God who created the gospel for all, has he prepared all peoples for the gospel? Are there little footprints around the world that make it possible that we could point to and say, oh, this and the Bible are the same thing? And so for the Chinese language, this is what we would go through. And you would tell the people, this is the oldest continuously written language in the world. It was first written over 4,500 years ago. And the inventors of this written language, they used pictures to express their words or ideas. And you would use simple pictures and put them together to make more complex thoughts. Now, this precedes the writing of the Pentateuch by Moses by several thousand years. So if anybody looks similar, the Chinese wrote it first before Moses wrote it. But you would take simple pictures and combine them. So for instance, if you wanted to say a mouth man, well, what is a mouth man? Well, that would be the oldest brother or the oldest son. Well, why would you say that? Well, generally the oldest child, the oldest male, was the mouth person or the spokesperson for the family. And so they would use these radicals. There's 214 radicals that they would put together to make about 30 to 50,000 ideograms. When we were over, most college students were in college not to really study an occupation. They were there to learn more words because you had to know how to put all these radicals together and ideograms together to make other ideograms. Well-known history, common everyday events were used for a word, make it easy to remember. If I said, remember 9/11, most of us have an idea what I'm talking about. Yesterday, remember Pearl Harbor. Most of us know what I'm talking about. I can use a very succinct statement to bring a whole flood of emotions and thoughts and history, and that's what they would do. Most people know China has a lot of Buddhists there, but most people don't know is that most Chinese people actually worshipped a creator god long before Buddha. And so if we look when the Chinese language was written and Buddhism came about before that, we have the first five books of the Bible written. And so we're in this gap here where the Chinese language was written and before Moses. The Chinese people started worshiping Shangdi. He was the god in China before Buddha. He was a creator god. They offered animal sacrifices to him. The problem was he was so holy. Eventually, only the elite or the aristocracy could worship this holy god. The common people were not holy enough to worship a holy god. Then only the emperor could worship, not just the aristocracy, but only the emperor. Then it moved to just once a year, the emperor would worship him in what was known as the border ceremony. But for the first three dynasties of China, the Sha, the Sheng, and the Chao, they worshiped Shangdi. But because people didn't have anybody to worship, there's this vacuum. We all need something to worship. And it's very interesting that when Buddhism came in from India into China, it's a celibate religion. It really can't propagate. There's no kids being born. But it took over like wildfire because there's a need for us to worship some sort of a god, whether it's the accurate, true god, or it's Buddha. Interestingly, missionaries in the 600s came to China. They were Nestorians from Syria. And so Alopun came to Chang'an in 635. Kublai Khan actually asked the Pope to send missionaries to China. They didn't. So then he invited the Muslims. And that's why there's a lot of Muslims in China. There's a lot less now because they're being persecuted by the Chinese government. But it wasn't until about the 1600s to 1800s that missionaries started coming back, bringing the Bible to China. But many people in China, because of this, believe that the Bible is a Western book. It's myths and fables written by Western men. What they don't understand is that it is not a Western book. You have to point out to them that it wasn't written in English. It was written in Hebrew and Greek, a little Aramaic thrown in. It was actually written in the area around Egypt and around Iraq. The first five books were written by Moses. He was the son of the king of Egypt. And it was written about their history. But the first 11 chapters are about all world history. And so with that, if we can show that the stories in the Bible and the Chinese language are identical, is there a commonality? Did somebody borrow from each other? What's the story? And what we want to do is we want to show that the Chinese characters show the stories of the first 11 chapters of Genesis, showing that there's a commonality there, that the ancient Chinese people knew the same stories as Moses. Well, how is that possible? Did Moses read Chinese? Did he get the stories from China through trade? Are these coincidental and these stories just happened to pop up halfway around the world at the same time? Or are they true and these people groups talked about their common ancestry? As we would go through the lessons, we would actually have the Chinese people read in their Bible these stories. We won't take the time to read all of the verses because you're well knowledgeable of these. The Tower of Babel, with the languages being divided. The main points of the story are the fact that the languages were divided and the people were scattered. Now, this happened about 5,000 years ago, about 500 years before the Chinese language was first penned, long before Moses wrote. Where did this happen? Most of us know, somewhere around the modern country of Iraq. And so if what Moses wrote was true, people would have traveled from Iraq and gone elsewhere after the languages were scattered. They would have moved or they would have migrated out of this area. If you were Chinese, how would you have gone? Well, you would have walked from the west into China, or maybe taken a horse cart or whatever, but you would have gone from the west. What is the Chinese word for to move or to migrate? Well, there's your ideogram. Can we break that one down into the radicals? We sure can. And I'm glad somebody did all this because I don't know Chinese. But you see the word here, walking. You see the word west. You see the word for great and the word for division. And so the people in China walked from the west after great division. That's pretty coincidental. Or is it? As we go through this lesson, just in your mind start saying, okay, when is this stop being a coincidence and when is this they're the same stories that they both understood? We would next go to Genesis 2, reading about God creating man. There's dust, there's breathing, and there's a living man. And since the Chinese language was first written, over the 4,500 years, things have been very complicated and gotten simplified. There's a radical that we'll look at that they really don't write anymore. It's kind of like shorthand, or script. You start losing some things. But the word for to create, you see this again, walking and talking. But what is talking made up of? You have dust, you have breathing or mouth or man, and you have alive. And so when we look at the idioms, and we look at the Bible, they agree. creation involves a living dust man who is walking. The word for first, alive, which is normally dropped by now, but you have a living dust man is first. Why would you write first as a living dust man? Well, according to the Chinese, the first man was a living dust man. According to Moses, the first man was a living dust man. How about the word for happiness or blessing? You can see it's made up of the symbol for Shangdi, one man, and garden. What's interesting is the garden has gotten simplified over time. It used to be squiggly lines representing rivers. How many squiggly lines are there? There's four. How many rivers were in Eden? There were four. Now, it could just be I'm a little OCD. I like the even, splitting everything up evenly. Why do three when you can do four and it looks more symmetrical? But it could be because there were four, coincidence or not. But in the beginning, you have God, one man, in a garden, and that truly is blessing or happiness to those who read the Bible. That word has evolved. It now means lucky, blessed or lucky. But you'll still see it today. We found it stamped on an apple. And in an antique store on what was probably a communion bench in a church pew, it's on the side. So it's still in use. Here's your question, geography. If Moses stole the stories from the Chinese, would the garden have been in the east or the west? It would have been in the west, because that's where the Chinese people were. But where Moses was, the garden was in the east. Makes sense that they both were looking at a similar spot, and which way did they travel? And so their word for west, you're going to recognize some of these. You got the man in first and the garden. So their word for west is one man in a garden. It's what Moses talked about. God looked at Adam, said it is not good for him to be alone. He needs a helpmate. What is the Chinese word for desire? To want or to desire? It's west and woman. But you remember what west is made up of? One man and a garden. So the need for to desire, to want, necessary, is a man and a garden and a woman. Is that coincidence? Possibly. We're stacking up a lot of coincidences between two people groups who lived a lot of distance away. What if you, instead of one, you put two together? Two people. That's the word for beginning or first. Why not 10? Why not 100? Why two? According to the ancient Chinese, two people started it all. Now we get into my favorite parts. Some of these, in the past, had ancient symbols, but this is where a lot of people would start recognizing what you're talking about for some of them. But as we go through the garden, there were lots of trees. But how many special trees were in the garden? There were two. The tree of knowledge of good and evil and the tree of life. And so we would get them to read this and to acknowledge how many trees. On the way home, we actually got to go spend a day in Beijing. We went to the Forbidden City. And one of the tour guides, or the little headset we were listening to, said, it's interesting, there's no trees in the middle of the Forbidden City. Now, further out there were, but in the middle of it, there weren't. And why? Well, you could hide assassins in a tree, so preservation. You also, the emperor was haughty, nothing could be higher than his head. So if you had a tree, somebody could get higher. But they said there was a third reason. And they said, we have a legend that because of trees, evil came into the world. We were like, oh, yeah, I know that story. They didn't know the story, but there's a legend that even in 2000 was being still passed down by oral history. And so their word for forbidden, because man was forbidden from eating of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. You can kind of guess what that top one's going to be. It's two trees and command. Why is the word for forbidden have two trees in it? A command about two trees. How about the woman with this forbidden fruit? The word for to covet or to desire. It's a very strong word in the Chinese. It has lust or sexual connotations with it. But the word for coveting or desiring, once again, you have two trees and woman. Why is it not a man and a Porsche? Why is it a woman? Well, who sinned first? I am sure if we read Adam took and then he gave to Eve, these symbols would be different. It would be two trees and man. The Chinese and Moses knew the same stories. How about moving further? The word for Satan or devil. Once again, you got the alive or motion. That one's dropped a lot. But the word for devil and Satan involved the use of the words garden, man, and secret or private. Nowadays, the United States is the great Satan to a lot of countries. So that might actually be used referencing us sometimes. But is that a coincidence? How about the word for tempter? If you take man, garden, and secret, you already recognize some of that. So you have the devil, which was man, garden, and secret, under cover of two trees. And that's the word for tempter. This is a fun one. The word for naked. There's actually three. I only had two here. But you notice there's a commonality between both of these. And so we put together man and fruit, or clothing and fruit, and we get the word naked. Why, with all three words, is fruit the common radical? Why not man? Why not fig leaves? It's because of fruit, they knew they were naked. Have we stopped being a coincidence and they are the same stories? How about pain? What was the woman's punishment? Her pain would be multiplied. You're seeing it again. A piece of two trees is pain. Now, I could see maybe this one, you know, you get beat with a stick, you know, there's always potentially something you could say, well, maybe that, but the stories just line up so well. Is that unique? How was man punished? He had to get work by the sweat of his brow. Weeds, thorns, and thistles. So if we look, the word for sorrow is ancient weeds. One thing we tried to stress is that there was a relationship that God and man have. And it's our guilt that separates them. And what's interesting is their word for righteousness. It's very complicated. But to make the word righteousness, you have to have me and sheep. And the word for me is hand and lance. So hand, lance, and sheep makes you righteous. That sounds just like what Moses talked about and what Jesus was as we read through the Bible, but especially those first 11 chapters. We read about sacrifices being made. What's interesting with this word for righteousness is the border ceremony I'd mentioned that the emperor was eventually the only one allowed to do. He would go to the winter palace, and at the winter solstice, 2 hours before noon, on a marble altar, he would offer a bullock to the creator god asking for a good harvest. Now, that was job security because only the emperor could offer it. So he made sure to go do that every year. Otherwise, if somebody else offered it, they could say, well, I'm the emperor. I did the border ceremony. Here's a trivia question for you. When did animal sacrifices end? Most of us say, well, AD 70, when the temple was destroyed. How about 1911? That was the last time the emperor of China offered a bull to the creator god. This complex that you see here was actually, this is the newest one. It was originally burnt. It was built. This one was built in 1300, burned down, and they kind of rebuilt it in 1700s. But it's been there for a long time. Are you good with homonyms? Words that are written different, pronounced the same. So we already know about the spokesman, the mouthman, the eldest son. Cain, the eldest son. What did he do? He murdered his brother. He was cruel or violent. And so their symbol for cruel or violent looks like the same one for eldest son, but it's like you have a mark on your forehead. That one might be a stretch, but I still found that fascinating. What's interesting with this as well is it is a homonym. And so older brother is Shun, and violent is Shun. They're pronounced the same, they're just written a little differently. This to me is where it just goes way beyond coincidence. Because it just, it can't be anything but these two are common. So as we read through with Noah, how many people were on the boat? Noah, his wife, three sons, their wives. 8 people. So if you're in China and you write the word for boat, and you want to say a big boat, and they actually were well known for their shipbuilding. They had huge ships. Hundreds of people could fit on them. But if you want to write the word for large ship, can you guess how many people you have to add to it? You have to add 8. Why not 10, 100, 1,000? Why only 8 people make it a big boat? Did the Chinese people know about Noah? Most certainly, I would say. Did Moses steal the story from the Chinese and write this about Noah only having 8 people? I doubt it. Their word for flood involves total water, but the word for total is 8 united in earth. Why only 8 united on an earth is the word for total? Because at one time that was the world's population and the Chinese people knew it. Did the Chinese people have the Bible? No. Moses penned this hundreds of years after this was written. But the Chinese people, to hand down or to continue, once again, 8 people involves handing down and continuing. Are they the only ones who knew about the flood? There's hundreds of flood stories around the world. Different people groups all had this. But the commonality they had is water destruction, right in there. So, the Epic of Gilgamesh, we're told Moses stole that from the Babylonians. How seaworthy was that? It was a cube. Have you ever tried to float a cube anywhere? It's not seaworthy. This past century and last century, they did a lot of experiments with boats. The dimensions that Moses gives us are the best ratio for having a very stable boat. It's not going to be a fast boat. It's going to be like a barge. It's stable, and it's going to float well. Did Moses know a lot about shipbuilding? Maybe. Or he could have just been quoting the numbers he knew and was told, and they were accurate. But how about other people groups? Well, the Greeks, when Paul got into Athens, he said, "You're very religious. Look at all these altars. They're to the unknown gods. Let me tell you about him." There's other historians who have talked about this altar to the unknown gods. And actually, you can go in museums and they've uncovered a number of them. But Diogenes, he wrote about some past philosophers, and he wrote about Epimenides. So who in the world was Epimenides? Well, he was a Cretan priest, a healer, a purifier, and a prophet. And as a matter of fact, Paul talks about him because Paul quotes him. Paul quotes him in Titus, and he says, a prophet of their own. So whether that's a true prophet or kind of tongue-in-cheek prophet, we're not sure. Your call. But there is this ancient history and tradition that he went to Athens because there was a plague, and they couldn't break it. And they called him to say, what do we need to do? And he said, well, obviously you've offended a god. You don't know which god. We'll figure it out. So take these groups of black and white sheep, get them hungry, and set them out to graze all over, it was Mars Hill. And if they lay down and don't eat, build an altar there. And that's where you need to worship this unknown God. And lots of sheep, just hungry, but they just laid down. They laid down rather than grazing. So they built all these altars, offered, and the plague was broken. They were offering to an unknown God. During that trip, he also prophesied about Persia's failed attempt that was going to happen in 10 more years, about conquering Greece. So I don't know if he was like Balaam, but this was 600 years before Paul. So God could have been speaking through Epimenides. But this was a setup because the Greeks knew their history. They had these altars. And Paul comes in and says, this happened 600 years ago. Let me tell you about this God that you're worshiping. How about the missionaries in the 1700s and 1800s? They were told, folks are set in their ways. You're going to go to these foreign countries and you're not going to be able to, it's going to be hard. You're not going to teach or convert anybody. And most of the time that was true. But there were some minority groups in some of these cultures. When they were told the gospel, it was like wildfire. To the point that some people, when they got a copy of the Bible, they traveled and went to as many villages as they could until they died of exhaustion. Why was somebody so excited and just so ecstatic about this? Well, they all had an oral tradition that there was a supreme God and only God that should be worshipped. But they were living in people who worshiped spirits and thousands of gods. But they remained true to this one God that they didn't know about. But the legend said there was a book that was lost. And someday someone would bring them the book, allowing them to return to worship of the one true creator God. And when the missionaries came and said, here is the God who sent his son to die for you, they said, that's the one we have been looking for. That is the book. And thousands obeyed. And so these minority groups kept true to a God they didn't know because their parents and their grandparents and their ancestors had passed down this oral tradition. In Burma, the Karen people, just read this hymn they had. This is long before the missionary showed up. The omnipotent is Yahweh. Him we have not believed. Yahweh created man anciently. He had a perfect knowledge of all things. Yahweh created man at the beginning. He knows all things to the present time. O my children and grandchildren, the earth is the treading place of the feet of Yahweh. The heaven is the place where he sits. He sees all things, and we are manifest to him. Can you doctrinally disagree with anything that's said there? I can't. And Yahweh and Yahweh, just when you start transliterating, those are very similar. So these people groups had a good knowledge of God. They just didn't know who he was. What about in Burma, the Karen, their story of the fall? Yahweh formed the world originally. He appointed food and drink. He appointed the fruit of trial. He gave detailed order. Mukawli deceived two persons. He caused them to eat the fruit of the tree of trial. They obeyed not. They believed not Yahweh. When they ate the fruit of trial, they became subject to sickness, aging, and death. They didn't have the Bible. Where did this story come from? Is this coincidence, or is this common knowledge across the world of the stories that Moses was able to pen for us? How about in India, the Santal? They had an oral tradition as well that Thakur Jui, which translates genuine God, so they call this a genuine God. They didn't worship him, but they knew all about him. And he created man and woman. They made rice beer at the enticement of Leda. They awoke and realized they were naked. Later, mankind was corrupted and destroyed in a flood while a holy pair was saved in a cave. After multiplication, the people were divided. And so their ancestors, as they came through the Himalayas, had problems finding passage. So they offered worship to spirit gods to get them through the Himalayas. And that's when they started worshiping other gods. And they forgot about the genuine God. But they still knew about him. So when the missionaries came and said, here's the Bible, a lot of those stories were very similar. How about the Baka in Central Africa? Well, they had an oral tradition as well. There was the creator, or Koro, that he sent his son into the world to accomplish something wonderful for all mankind. Their forefathers turned from the truth. They forgot what it was Korah's son had accomplished. But messengers would come to restore the knowledge. And so when missionaries showed up, they said, this is Korah. This is what his son did. And for a while, 70 to 80% of the native-born African preachers were all from the Baka tribe because they knew about him. They had just forgotten him. What's really interesting is their tribal rites of passage. When you become go from a young boy to an adult, there's a blood sacrifice that is offered. There's an animal that's offered. But then there's water immersion followed by several days of acting like a newborn child, where the person who has been immersed in water, who has been baptized, literally people feed him by hand, and he can't talk, and he babbles, and he acts like a newborn baby. A lot about what we read about Korah's son accomplishing something wonderful for mankind. Even in the Americas, what about the Incas? Pachacuti, the last Inca king, he started questioning about Inti, the sun god. He said, how can this sun god be universal if he gives light to some and withholds it from others? He's always moving. He's never at rest. He can't be perfect. And he isn't all-powerful because a little cloud can block him. So how is this somebody we should worship? And he returned the upper class to the worship of Viracocha, who was the ancient, uncreated, supreme god. And so he was on the right path. There is a God who is the uncreated God. He is the supreme God. The problem was the priests didn't allow the masses to know about this. They said, it's okay if y'all do it, but we need to let everybody keep worshiping because I need a job, basically. And then the Spaniards came and wiped them all out. But he was on the right path. As we look through the world around us, not everybody had a true knowledge of God. Some of these, they didn't have a true knowledge either, but they knew a lot. But the God who created the gospel for all has left his footprints around the world. Tonight, we're going to look at the world around us just to say, can we see, does anything there point us to God? As a physician on Monday night, I can tell you, you can't look at the human body, you can't look at how we are made, how we develop, and not know that there is a God unless you put your head in the sand. It is just statistically impossible for all of that to have happened. It defies description. But the God who made us all, made the gospel for all of us, desires all of us to be his child. And there is a way that he put that in place. Just like some of these people knew, he sent his son to accomplish something wonderful. To have a God that we turned our back on. To have a God that we sinned and did what he didn't want us to do and continue to do. But for that God to be willing to say, I forgive you. I want you to be my child and I want you to live for all eternity as my child is amazing. We all should be like these people, running out to the point of exhaustion, telling others about the good God has done for us. But right now we have an opportunity that if you have not accepted the gift of God, there's no better time than now to do it. So if you need to repent and be baptized in the water for forgiveness of sins, or if you need to come forward for a sin that you need to ask for the prayers of the congregation, please do so as we stand and sing.